Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Today, a focus in Detroit as it emerges from the largest municipal bankruptcy in American history. We've got two perspectives in the story. First, in Moments, Shay Howell offers an activist look at the crisis and a possible way out. And towards the bottom of the hour, former securities lawyer and investment banker Wallace Turbeville runs the numbers and finds the official story at odds with the facts. The city of Detroit filed for bankruptcy in July 2013, making it the largest city in American history to go bust officially. New York went through a bankruptcy proceeding in all but name in 1975, but never went for a formal filing. The Detroit filing was the decision of Kevin Orr, who was appointed emergency manager of the city several months earlier by reactionary Michigan Governor Rick Snyder. Orr was a partner in the Cleveland-based law firm Jones Day, the third largest legal practice in the world. He handled the 2009 Chrysler bankruptcy, for which he billed $700 an hour. On taking the emergency manager job, Orr left Jones Day, but perhaps coincidentally, he hired the firm to represent the city in bankruptcy proceedings. Bills from lawyers and consultants now total about $140 million, and the full bankruptcy tab could rise to $200 million, a staggering sum for a city whose annual operating expenses are about $700 million. Which is $400 million below where they were in 2008, which should give you a taste of the savage austerity the city has been living through. In a corporate bankruptcy, it's often, though certainly not always, the case that a firm's underlying business is healthy, but it's operating under too great a debt burden. Wiping away some or all of the debt can give a corporation a new lease on life. Detroit, however, is a different case entirely. It's suffering from decades of economic and population decline. It does have a debt problem, but the core of Detroit's troubles is that long decline. It's not clear that bankruptcy will do anything to resolve that or begin a real turnaround for the city. My first guest is Shay Howell. She's a member of the People's Water Board and Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management. Shay Howell. Give us some perspective. How long you're a longstanding Detroiter?
Yes, I've been in Detroit for more than 40 years. So I guess that makes me long-standing.
Yes, I guess it does. So I guess you've seen quite a lot of decline and distress in those 40 years.
Well, of course I've seen decline and distress, but I've also seen extraordinarily imaginative redevelopment. One of the things your listeners may or may not know is Detroit's an international leader in the urban gardening movement because we've had to face the consequences of what it means to have the auto industry leave, what it means to try to create a life in a post-industrial world.
So what's life been like since the bankruptcy filing?
Well, this has been an extraordinary assault on the people of Detroit. Part of it is that most people in Detroit did not believe that we needed to file bankruptcy in the first place. There was a publication by Demos, which is a certainly nonpartisan, an analyst of the situation, and they pointed out that Detroit had a shortfall, but the notion that we had this vast debt was in many ways inflated. And much of that debt was created by the willful withdrawal of state money for the city. And that willful withdrawal or the refusal to fund the city is what precipitated this particular financial crisis. So from the very beginning, people in Detroit have felt that the financial crisis was created in order to take over the assets of the city by corporate interests. And that does appear to be the case.
And the governor is certainly no friend of Detroit, right?
No, he's no friend of Detroit, and if you just look at the last election results, he got 93-plus percent of the vote against the governor, and that was true in every urban area where he has imposed emergency management. So to whatever degree this current election is looked at as a referendum on his policies, every city that has suffered from his policies rejected him soundly.
And what other cities are in similar straits?
Well, there are five. There's Detroit, Pontiac, Benton Harbor, Hamtramck, Highland Park, and Inkster. And these are cities that are primarily black. In fact, one of the stories not told about this is that 55% of the African-American population has lost the right to vote for effective local government. And 75% of the African-American elected officials in the state were removed from power by this governor.
Yeah, I recall the bankruptcy of New York City, and what happened then was that essentially bankers and the state took the city over, and there was no elected local government making anything but the most trivial decisions. That's pretty much the model that was used in Michigan?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, not even trivial decisions. They were only allowed to meet at the will of the emergency manager.
So who was the emergency manager in Detroit's case, and how did he run the city?
Well, this emergency manager's name was Kevin Orr, and he was, until he took the job, a partner of Jones Day Law Firm, which is touting itself as the number one law firm for municipal bankruptcies. They've cost us over $100 million. Orr had absolutely no experience running the city, and perhaps the best place where you saw that was over the water crisis, which he precipitated. He insisted that the water department demonstrate its viability by shutting off thousands and thousands of people who were behind on their water bills, while not shutting off a single corporation.
And what about the rest of city governance? So what happened with the schools and you know, basic services?
The schools are on a separate emergency manager, as they have been for more than a decade. And we have gone in that decade from 145,000 students in public schools to less than 44,000 students in public schools. And just this week, the mayor announced that he is selling off 70 public school facilities, which are in no need of being closed. He's closing those, selling them, and increasing class size. So our school systems have been decimated by the emergency manager. The only thing that he has increased has been the police force for obvious reasons.
And what about city employees? What's been happening with them?
Well, city employees were by and large let go. In the city of Pontiac, for example, they went from over 600 to less than a dozen city employees under an emergency manager. We have had a vast majority of our city employees have been laid off. Entire departments have been closed. So, for example, under the water crisis, ordinarily we would have information from a public health department, but we no longer have a public health department. That's just been simply shut down. And, of course, with the bankruptcy itself, former city employees have taken an enormous hit in this so-called restructuring. As much as 80% of the savings have been taken from pensions and health care benefits.
Now, of course, some people might be listening and saying, yes, well, the problem is Detroit is broke. There's just not the money for these things. What else could he have done? What do you say to that?
Well, we actually demonstrate a number of things they could have done. But just today, for example, there was a conversation about the fact that the people in Detroit who work in suburban communities, which is the majority of the people in the city. If you have a job, it's not likely to be in Detroit. There is no compulsion for any suburban community to collect income tax and return it to the city of Detroit. So there's no force of law that allows Detroit to capture roughly, they think probably $140 million a year is being lost in that one move alone. So if the state legislature was really concerned about Detroit, the first thing they would do would be to enact a law so we can recover lost income tax, which would be fairly close to almost half of our annual budget.
What is the city's annual budget?
Our budget shortfall is $195 million.
And so being able to collect that commuter tax would then go a long way to solving the problem.
That sure would. And that's just one issue. The other issue is that we have lost over $600 million in revenue sharing from the state. And that's true not only of Detroit, but that's true of all municipalities in the state.
And the governor, I presume, governs for what, the suburban audience? Is that his primary constituency?
Well, if you look at who voted for him, they were generally older white suburban voters. And that's who voted, although he got fewer of those this time than he did last time. But, yes, he caters to suburban audiences, and he touts himself as the person who has been able to bring Detroit back into line, which we think, of course, is a code for saying that he's been able to bring Detroit back into the white power structure.
There's barely any coding on that, right?
Yeah, barely coding, yes.
Detroit is exiting the bankruptcy. What's that deal look like?
Well, Well, we are hoping, and in fact, some of the pensioners today at our news conference said that they intend to challenge the bankruptcy. The first thing that it looks like is that the banks were not at all held accountable for any of the swap deals. And I understand you'll have someone talking about those later. But even the judge had said that he thought these deals could probably be challenged in court. But in order to move through the bankruptcy, he did not allow that. So the first thing is the banks got away with a great deal. The second thing is that many of the creditors, particularly the insurers, got vast tracts of land in the city for nothing. And the third thing is that some of these corporate creditors also got revenue-producing things, such as the tunnel that goes between Detroit and Canada, and also some of the major parking structures in the city, which have been revenue-producing, but that money will now go to corporate debtors.
That's actually kind of shocking. I mean, the creditors got city assets and are going to pocket the money.
Yes, that's exactly what I mean. Creditors got city assets and they're going to pocket the money. And one of those city assets, for example, is the Joe Louis Arena, which has just been abandoned by the Red Wings hockey team to build a new arena for $600 and some million. And three-quarters of that money is coming from public funds.
And will that be in Detroit or in the suburbs?
That will be in Detroit. And in fact, he got 39 lots for $1.
Any idea what the creditors are going to do with these assets?
Well, I think a lot of them are going to make some money on them. I think the Joe Louis Arena is right on the Detroit riverfront. It's a beautiful piece of property. And that's apparently going to be knocked down and turned into a hotel and convention and entertainment complex.
I'm speaking with Shay Howell, a Detroit-based activist who is with the People's Water Board and also the Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management. Well, Detroit has tried hotel convention entertainment complexes in the past and haven't really sparked any kind of meaningful growth. So they're just going down that path again.
Yes, exactly. In fact, what this bankruptcy does is put in place a lot of the already failed strategies for redevelopment. And it's doing it at the expense of the strategies that are actually working in the city, which are strategies that encourage art, that encourage the use of public land for urban gardening, that encourage neighborhoods to buy houses and repurpose them. There are a lot of strategies that are working at the neighborhood level, and all of those are being eviscerated by this current plan.
How's that happening? I mean, how these approaches undermined?
Well, the first thing is that there will be no money for any kind of neighborhood development. There are most of the money is being used to hire police and fire, and it's even really questionable whether or not we need additional police and fire. There have been numerous studies to say that it's really a question of how we are structuring these. But it's not for neighborhood stabilization or neighborhood development. The second thing is the federal money, which had been targeted for helping people fix up their homes, is being used to tear down homes rather than repair them under the name of blight removal. And then that property is being bundled together and auctioned off to large-scale developers rather than neighborhood groups.
Yeah, I was going to ask more about the role of the federal government in this crisis. Has it been active, and what, if so, what have they been doing?
Actually, other than the use of HUD monies to buy properties and to support the so-called blight efforts, the federal government has been very silent about the bankruptcy process. In fact, it was the silence of the federal government that drove us go to the United Nations to raise a question of human rights here in Detroit, which you may be aware, the human rights special rapporteurs for both housing and water came to Detroit and found the city to be in violation of basic rights. There was nothing from the federal government.
And I'm guessing the reaction of the power structure to the UN rapporteurs is, so what, right?
Well, that would be a generous comment, yes. They said, so what?
I remember the famous Daily News headline from the New York City bankruptcy days, Ford to City, drop dead. Do you feel like people are saying the same to Detroit?
I think it depends on who's saying it. I think some people are saying bankruptcy is here. Now it's time for us to really grab a lot of the city that we've wanted all along. I mean, you have to remember that Detroit is primarily an African-American city, and in the last 10 years, roughly half the wealth of the city has been lost in the foreclosure crisis. Now the head of the Blight Task Force to deal with the residue of the foreclosure crisis is Dan Gilbert, the man who made most of the loans in the first place to Detroit.
Through what institution was he?
Through Quicken Loans.
And so now he has these distressed properties for pennies in the dollar, I presume.
Yes. Well, yes, he owns over 60 buildings downtown.
And any idea what he plans to do with them?
Well, some of them he's turning, yes, as he put his plans out quite, he's turning them into a entertainment complex. I mean, obviously the view for the redevelopment of downtown is that the 7.2 miles in the Gilbert and Illich areas will be upscale entertainment that will be whiter and wealthier, and the rest of the city will be left to languish, except for a few select neighborhoods.
I was wondering what they see as the customer base for these entertainment complexes.
Next to Detroit is Oakland County, one of the richest counties in the nation. While we are a poor city, we are a wealthy metropolitan area. And the desire for a vibrant central city is quite clear, because right now the center area has almost a 95% occupancy rate, which is unheard of. So vast parts of the city are open land, and other parts are now experiencing extraordinary displacement of people who've lived there for many, many years.
So this will be sort of an urban playground for suburbanites, with the residents not even really entering to the consideration.
Right, unless they work there to clean up.
This is really a rather depressing vision.
Well, it's not the only vision. I mean, I think it's really important to see the extraordinary creativity that is happening outside the central city.
Yes, tell us some about that. Be more encouraging as we run to the final minutes.
Yes, well, if you were to drive through Detroit right now, this is harvest time. There are hundreds, actually thousands, of small urban gardens that are producing for local needs. We have a vibrant local farmers markets, not only in the Eastern Market, which is one of the largest farmers markets in the country, but at the neighborhood level, we have small corner markets that are created through these farmer gardens. We also have an extraordinary art scene that is created by young people of all ethnicities who are using the urban setting in new ways to everything from the Heidelberg Project, which takes found objects and recreates an urban vision, to people who are doing extraordinary work in film and music and muraling throughout the city. Also, if you take a look at some of our schools, we have very vigorous emerging place-based education where the curriculum is being drawn from the question of how do we restore community? How do we learn as we redevelop our neighborhoods and our streets? So all of that is happening at the neighborhood level and is completely out of sight from the bankruptcy process.
Any ideas on how to foster economic development to create some jobs in the city?
Well, there is a tremendous amount of work being done right now with local production for local needs. Everything from creating housing and furniture with advanced 3D printing skills to the creation of all sorts of foodstuffs and clothing. So there is a local economic market where people are producing virtually everything people need at the local level and are, in fact, creating rather visionary production. We have electric motorcycles, electric bicycles. We have people who are developing all sorts of methods of advanced technologies connected to urban agriculture to monitor soil content and water content. So there's a lot of creativity that is creating a local job market for local needs that is outside of the view of the mainstream media.
I was wondering, there must be still a lot of people with skills from the days when the auto industry was there. I mean, the idea, it seems tempting to try to repurpose that or redirect that into creating ecologically friendly transportation. People thinking about that?
Yeah, that's definitely happening. As I said, there's the whole move around electric motorcycles and some electric cars that are happening. But I think more importantly, people are using those skills to create self-sufficient neighborhoods. So, for example, there's a man who has created windmills to provide both electricity and water in his neighborhood, so that people are taking machine skills and using those to design machines that enable people to move off the grid and, in fact, enable people to generate electricity and sell it back to the grid.
And what about the water situation? Are people getting reconnected, or are there still people without water?
No, actually, they're still shutting people off. There are about 9,000 people without water, and the shutoffs are continuing. We are continuing to protest that in the city. The United Nations was just here 2 weeks ago for another visit. The water department has just been moved into a regional authority, and as that unfolds, people are definitely organizing to pressure them for two things. One, to acknowledge a rate structure that makes water a human right, and two, to acknowledge the necessity of seeing water as a public trust. And both of those efforts are moving ahead very strongly in the city.
Yeah, I think the way the press outside of Detroit has conveyed this is that there was a clean deal. Everything happened quicker than possible, or anybody would have imagined. And they made the bankruptcy settlement made the best of a bad situation. That is completely at odds with the way you see it, correct?
Yes, that's totally at odds. And by the way, one of the reasons it happened so quickly is because everybody sort of agreed to the outline before Kevin Orr was even appointed emergency manager. One of the things that came out in this whole bankruptcy hearing were the emails from the governor to Jones Day to Kevin Orr, where they were essentially all agreeing on the general direction before he even took office. So it shouldn't be a surprise to us that they came to agreement so quickly.
And, of course, Orr and Jones Day are making a business out of this now from their Detroit experience.
Yes, yes. In fact, Kevin Orr just spoke in Italy at something called the Global Restructuring Organization, which purports itself to become the WTO of bankruptcy. And I hope that's something you would explore.
Yes, that's something very much worth looking into. But meanwhile, the people of Detroit have a different idea of how to restructure things.
Yes, and in fact, we are restructuring things no matter what they intend to do, because generally speaking, what they are planning, as you pointed out, are failed strategies of the past.
Okay, well, best of luck.
That was Shay Howell, an activist with the People's Water Board and Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management. I'm not really convinced that urban farming and off-the-grid power generation schemes will really turn Detroit around. They seem more like mechanisms for coping with a world that really doesn't give a damn about the city. But I hope I'm wrong. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of American Ruse by MC5. Next up, Wallace Turbeville. He is a former securities lawyer and investment banker who is now a fellow at the Demos think tank in New York. He's been writing about the Detroit crisis for the last couple of years. His November 2013 paper is a definitive refutation of official misinformation about the topic. You can find it and his shorter pieces on the city at demos.org. Wallace Turbeville.
Detroit has exited bankruptcy. What's your impression of the deal that emerged?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on so I could speak to the good people around the country. I think that it's the deal itself sort of depends on from where you observe it. If you think about what could have happened had all of the parties worked in concert very early on with the situation that was arising in Detroit, it's a very, very poor deal indeed. On the other hand, from the perspective of how bad it could have been, as of about a year ago, before many of the folks out in Detroit started making themselves heard appropriately in the court and in the court of public opinion, both, it has some good aspects.
So what was avoided? What could have been worse?
What could have been worse? The one of the things that could have been worse is that a number of financial institutions that undoubtedly did not deserve to be paid off would have been paid off, and hundreds of millions of dollars would have been unavailable, ultimately to the pensioners and in the first instance, and more widely to all the people of Detroit. That could definitely have happened. It was on its way to happening.
And those are the swap deals?
Well, the swap deals in particular.
Yeah.
Also, the terms under which some insurance companies that were in the business of guaranteeing the debt of the city of Detroit, how those things worked out. So between the swaps and those financial guarantors, it could have been much worse.
Okay, I want to get to the swaps in some detail a little later, but let's start with the history of the bankruptcy filing. How did it happen?
What happened was that the city suffered terribly during the Great Recession. It was affected like no other large city, and I think that one of the things that I tried to do in the report was point out that certainly Detroit has a long history of problems in terms of its economy, but it got completely crushed in the Great Recession, with unemployment surging to 30%, something like 70% of the loans in recent years were subprime. Huge numbers of foreclosures. And so the city simply stated ran out of cash. I mean, the city could be in poor economic conditions, but could plan its cash. Well, it lost the ability to plan its cash, and the coup de grace was when the state cut $67 million in annual state aid. That sort of was the last straw, as it were. So what happened was the city was running out of cash. And at the beginning of 2013, the state evoked a relatively new state law that allowed the state to put in an emergency manager that took complete control of the city. And the emergency manager, by July, determined that it was that he would file for bankruptcy, which is what he did. He filed in court for bankruptcy.
And that emergency manager, Kevin Orr, is a partner, Jones Day.
He was a partner at Jones Day and became the emergency manager. He was sort of seconded, if you will. He was no longer a partner at Jones Day, but he employed Jones Day as the principal law firm that represented the interests of the city in the bankruptcy. So this former Jones Day partner, who maybe is a future Jones Day partner, could well be. But went in with his law firm as emergency manager and really had plenary power over the city of Detroit.
And Jones Day stands to book about over $100 million in fees on this.
Well, the total amount of fees and cost of the bankruptcy is close to, I've seen a couple of estimates, $130 million, $150 million, somewhere in that range, though, which is a healthy sum of money. And one wonders maybe a different path would have been helpful, but that is an enormous amount of money on a city that probably has a population of something like 650,000 or less now.
Some of the underlying causes of the crisis. Well, let's talk first about some of the myths that have spread around the manager and the press and conventional thinking. emphasize out-of-control spending and out-of-control debt. Let's deal with those.
Yeah, first of all, the appointment of emergency manager is something that people did not endorse. I mean, they elected officials and they liked their representation. So the appointment of an emergency manager, especially one that comes out of a state governor and legislature of a different party, is problematic. So in order to be justified as an emergency manager, there has to be an emergency, right? So there was clearly an effort to inflate the amount of debt.
Yeah, they came up with, what, $18 billion in debt?
Yeah, and to this day, even the articles reporting the conclusion of the bankruptcy, the lead is $18 billion of debt, which one of the things I try to do is point out that $18 billion, it's not like a large number, especially for a city that size. It was a number that was constructed, and there's clearly no way that you can say with a straight face that the city was $18 billion in debt. That was something that was spun up, if you will, because of trying to suggest the grave problems. The best example of that is that the water and sewer services in that part of the world are run by something called the City of Detroit Water Department. In fact, they sit inside the City of Detroit. But it's really an organization that operates water and sewerage services for 40% of the entire state of Michigan. And just because they got that in their name doesn't mean that their $5.8 billion of debt should have been recognized as part of the $18 billion.
And then on the expense side, the picture of Detroit's out-of-control spending is also at odds with the numbers.
Yeah, I mean, in recent years, the city had drastically cut the number of employees and the budget. It's as plain as day that the city was leased, really before the Great Recession kicked in, but certainly during it, was trying to cut as fast as revenues were falling. And so instead of out of control spending, it was really cut, cut, cut. And we did some analysis of the cities of St. Louis and Cleveland, and we use those cities because that's what the emergency manager used in a lot of his filings as comparable cities, and concluded that on the spending side, the city of Detroit is frugal or more frugal than those other two comparable cities. What they were running into was a sort of a death spiral in terms of revenues, not in terms of wild, uncontrolled spending.
So the fundamental problem was decades-long economic decline capped by the Great Recession, which is really what did Detroit in.
Yeah, I mean, it's the last blow that kills you, I guess. The Great Recession was just, in the case of Detroit, was just hugely problematic. Not a shock. I mean, there were things about Detroit. For instance, the auto industry. As we recall, that went through tremendous changes post 2008. So, and it had to be bailed out, as a matter of fact. So, many, many things conspired to cause a sudden and violent constriction of revenue, which is what happened, and they did run out of cash. There's no question about that. But also, you've got to take into consideration the ill-timed state decision to withdraw a large amount of state subsidy.
It's important to make a conceptual distinction between a municipal bankruptcy and a corporate bankruptcy, right?
Sure. I mean, and then you saw it play out graphically in the city of Detroit. A couple of things that are notable. One is that you don't liquidate a city. It's not like you hang tags off of fire engines and then auction them off. The city has to function. There's a public interest in it. So the fact that there's no liquidation possible changes the whole approach. And moreover, bankruptcy courts, based on long history even before the bankruptcy law, this sort of ancient history of how courts deal with municipalities, stay away from policy decisions. So the courts are not going to change policy, or they should not change policy. They should help the city adjust its liabilities, which is more or less what the court here did, although it's a very, so it's not exactly a bright line between the two. But the notion is that the policy and the direction of the city is for the people, and its liabilities are for the court in a municipal bankruptcy, which is under a completely different chapter from, you know, personal bankruptcies or corporate bankruptcies under our code.
And on the revenue side, the city gave away enormous amounts of subsidies to corporations to spur economic development, which may have happened anyway. How big a factor was that in the revenue shortfall?
That was the hardest part of the whole analysis that we did, because it's very hard to say what would have happened had there not been a subsidy. And that's what it comes down to. There's no question that two things are for certain. Tens, hundreds of millions of dollars were granted over the last few years in subsidies to spur development, especially in downtown Detroit. And we know that. And we also know that there's a lot of work amongst economists and sort of academic studies that suggest those kinds of subsidies don't really spur development, certainly not on a value per dollar basis. But in the specifics, especially under the problematic circumstances that the city was in, we can't really say how much of that would have happened or would not have happened, depending on the subsidy. But we know that it was a lot, and it was problematic.
I'm speaking with Wallace Turbeville, who is a fellow at the Demos think tank in New York City. And on the expense side also, Wall Street banks sold a lot of complex instruments to the city to finance itself. Tell us about those and what was up.
Yeah, the city of Detroit was a place where, you know, I was a municipal banker at Goldman Sachs for 12 years. And before that, I was a municipal finance lawyer at a Wall Street firm. There is something that's sort of a rule of that business of being that kind of banker, is the more desperate your client, the more money you can make. And so the city of Detroit's circumstances were very much along those lines. I think emblematic of the whole thing was a transaction they did back in 2006. And at the time, the mayor was Kwame Kilpatrick, who was now serving time for bad activities when he was mayor. It's serving time at the pleasure of the state. So that's not to say that anybody knows for sure that there was problems with these deals and that along those lines, but it certainly wouldn't be a total shock if that were true. At any rate, they did a transaction. They were behind in their deposits to the pension fund to put money aside for future retirees, and they were far enough behind that they were going to violate some rules. So what they did was they issued ultimately $1.4 billion worth of debt and took the money that they got for that debt, what they borrowed, and put it into the pension fund. And all presto changeo, the pension fund was funded. Of course, they had the $1.4 billion in debt. In order to do that, they would have, just borrowing money the regular way, they would have violated a lot of rules about having too much outstanding that the state had for all of its cities. There's only so much debt you can just take on without getting some special approvals. And they instead of getting the approvals, they rigged it up this transaction that looked a little bit like debt for an investor standpoint, but was a, sort of a Rube Goldberg structure that hid the fact that the city was borrowing the money. So that was questionable to start with. Then on top of that, they layered on a derivative, which is that's the kind of financial arrangement that, for instance, AIG, when they went bust and we had to bail them out in 2008, and Lehman had real problems with derivatives, right? Because derivatives are very risky. The city, on top of the $1.4 billion, did a related $800 million derivative transaction, very long term, very risky. So this particular transaction was bristling with problems. And when we did our analysis of the city, we suggested that the proper tactic for the emergency manager would be to challenge those aggressively, either threatening to go to court to say that they were not valid and should be voided by the courts, or at least if you don't go to court, certainly threaten and try to negotiate a low number in any sort of settlement. And the emergency manager indeed was not doing that when we wrote about it, but subsequently was forced to do it because the court agreed with the same approach that we were looking at, and saying that they should, that they, the city need to aggressively threaten, if you will, voiding those deals so as to get a much lower settlement, which is ultimately what happened.
And one of the things they did was they borrowed at floating rates and then used the derivative to convert it to fixed rates instead of just borrowing at fixed rates in the first place. I can see the advantage for the bank in that they can vary a lot of fees in the arrangement. Why would a city enter into such a thing?
I could, you know, I've been around enough to have seen banks make those pitches to cities. And what they'll say is, well, you know, you've sort of used up all of the fixed rate lenders or bondholders that are out there, so you need to open up, broaden your market, and place the debt in floating rate markets. But don't worry about it. We'll enter into a contract that will synthetically fix the rate. And by doing that, it'll be a little bit cheaper than further saturating the market for fixed rate debt. So it's a supply and demand thing, right? You're going to another source of capital funding. Because you're tapping a new source, you can get a somewhat lower interest cost. Of course, the problem with that is if you are simultaneously doing a transaction that's so complex and risky that you're risking the entire city in terms of its financial viability, that's not a good deal for a little bit of savings to do that. I don't know why they did it. I wasn't there. But I do know that's the typical this typical pitch. And generally speaking, it sounds good, but it leaves out the big issue of, are you gambling with the people's money, and which is, in fact, what happened. And eventually, that's exactly what happened. And one of the things that tipped them into bankruptcy was that the derivatives deal was, the default was imminently going to be called, which would have, the banks would have been able to take virtually all of the free cash flow of the city. So that's ultimately what happened.
Now, when I see these things, I always wonder, are the civil servants just outclassed by Wall Street Sharpies, or are the civil servants looking to post-municipal employment?
It's an interesting question. I'm actually in New York going to presenting that specific question, talking on that specific question on Thursday at an event sponsored by the Haas Institute at UC Berkeley. Yeah, I think it's a mix. I think that almost universally the finance professionals at state and local governments are unable to keep up with the complexity of these deals. I mean, and that's not because they're not good at what they do. It's because I think people at corporations have trouble with that too. I think it's because the level of sophistication of the banks is just so high. And, you know, there's just a huge concentration of very high-level quantitative folks. On the other hand, I think there's also a level of influence that's brought to bear on elected officials through means that I'm sure your listeners all could imagine, and also in some of the finance professionals in terms of getting rewards by getting jobs. Again, I don't know the circumstances, but the finance director of the city of Detroit, shortly after this transaction happened, moved on from that job into a private regional banking firm that was part of the deal. So, you know, there is a little bit of a revolving door issue. There's a significant revolving door issue as well. So, misunderstanding, undue influence because of the typical kinds of influences that contractors bring to bear on cities, and the revolving door of some of the finance professionals. I think all three occur may have all occurred in the Detroit situation.
And a corporate bankruptcy, very often you have a corporation whose underlying business is viable, but it just has too much debt. And if you can clear away some of the debt, the company can come back to life and survive. In the case of Detroit, it doesn't seem like any of the underlying problems have been fixed. We still have an economy that's a wreck without much in the way of prospects. Does the bankruptcy solve much in the longer term?
Well, that's a very insightful point, because we go back and we say, you know, the court is not supposed to address policy issues, for instance. In a bankruptcy, the courts address some of the liabilities. That means that the hard decisions are yet to be made. In bankruptcy, a bankruptcy court's not going to make those decisions. Frankly, we don't want them to. What we want is people through their elected representatives to make those decisions. Now, Detroit has an opportunity here. Unfortunately, they're going to come out of this because of some funding that the state put up. The quid pro quo for that was to be under a committee that's largely appointed by the governor of the state that will oversee, you know, their finances and what they do. But there are a lot of policy choices the city can make and the city's representatives can make. And the key thing here is going to be, and we just don't know, because the bankruptcy didn't resolve these issues and couldn't have. We don't know whether the future of the city of Detroit is just bleak, or whether it will be developed as a very different kind of city. And I think by saying that, I mean whether there'll be a gentrification which will change the demographics. It's a largely African-American city now. Is it going to become largely white? We don't know. Or will the new resurrection of the city of Detroit be broad and will lift up all the communities? And I, for one, would like to see the latter occur. And it can occur. I have faith in it occurring. It hasn't, you know, we haven't really proven how well we can do that in this country. But if the city and the state and indeed the federal government participate to try to do that, to lift up the current residents and preserve the city of Detroit as a very special place that it always has been, it can be done. It's a question of will. It's not a question of resources. We have the money to do it.
And finally, you've written about American capitalism today as being a really kind of decadent rentier sort of capitalism. Does this Detroit bankruptcy, what's happened to it in recent decades, and then the bankruptcy process, does this look like a case study in that rentier decadence to you?
Oh my goodness, yes. A lot of the thinking in that area sort of contrasts the immediate post-war era and today, right? And the theories as they go is, you know, are we really at our very nature more like the 19th century robber barons, where the rich just get richer, and the middle and lower income levels stagnate, which is what's going on, by the way. So the question is, are we returning to our nature, and was the period between the end of the war and say about 1980 or so, or a little bit later, whether that was an anomaly, or whether that's real, right? Are we returning to our nature, or can we get back to that era of the 50s, 60s, and 70s? Well, the thing is, the city of Detroit is a complete metaphor for that. I mean, the city of Detroit was the center of the middle class, and the center of the American worker, and the opportunities through hard work to lift yourself up. In 1950, it was a city of 2 million people. And again, now it's probably a city of somewhere in the 600,000, so we don't know for sure. So that the metaphor is unbelievable in terms of, you know, what the auto companies did, in terms of how the city prospered, the migration patterns, all the rest. It's absolutely emblematic of what's going on in this country.
Well, you know, the robber barons of the late 19th century, though, they were creating railroads and steel mills. The robber barons of today are creating Airbnb and Uber.
That's true, and worse than that, they're creating the business of banking for banking's sake, right? So one of the things that's happened is that the size of the finance sector in relation to the whole rest of the economy has doubled in the last 30 years, meaning finance is somehow been considered a growth industry, and I'm continually baffled by that, since it doesn't create jobs to speak of, and it's really parasitic on other capital raising. So, you know, so not only are we doing Airbnb and Uber, even more so, we're doing high frequency traders that are moving money around at nanosecond speeds, with, you know, through using computer programs. So, to me, that's as troubling as some parts of the economy are. That was a little more troubling to me.
That was Wallace Turbeville, a former securities lawyer and investment banker, who is now a fellow at the Demos think tank in New York. For more, visit demos.org. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Strings of Life by Derek May, one of the foundational documents of Detroit techno. Till next week, bye.